The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
How wonderful. Thank you very much. I always used to dream of coming onto a stage and being applauded before I'd done anything. So... So you've already made my dreams come true. So thank you. I got to say, it's a thrill to be here in Philadelphia. I couldn't possibly stand up here without acknowledging the fact that this city's been so important to us in our career. It's one of the very first places we came to as Queen many, many, many years ago. You know, and it's... We owe you a lot. You know, we grew up here, really, in this one of the great capitals of rock music. And I went to MMR this morning, and I kind of felt at home, which was wonderful. And they were great. Anybody hear that? Yeah. Oh, good. So I'd like to say a few thank yous, and people usually do this at the end, but I'd like to do it at the beginning, just to kind of set the scene here. I want to say thank you to Greg Dinkins, who's down there, a very good friend and a fellow author in stereoscopy, a luminary of the National Stereoscopic Association, which we just visited. Greg Dinkins is handling the projection, and we thank him greatly. He's fantastic. Also, thank you to his lovely daughter, Lily, who is here with him, and she's been sticking all your spectacles together, so we owe her a great... Thank you. Thank you to Paul Bednar of the establishment, who's been setting us up here this afternoon. We really appreciate that. And Andy Cahan, who supervised this whole thing of getting us up and running today. We have a couple of people here from England, I'm happy to say. Emma O'Brien is from Francis Lincoln, our English publisher. Very happy that you're here, Emma. And my own lovely daughter, Emily, is also here. She's been taking care of testing my credit card and doing the shopping. She's an essential part of the organization. Treacherous this is. Of course, I'm here because of my colleague and co-author, Elena Vidal, who's from Spain. She's from San Sebastian, and she's a Basque. So watch out. She speaks about 15 languages, and you've got to be really careful around her, I tell you. She has also taught me everything that I know about conservation since I was introduced to her about 15 years ago. And she's been a fantastic teacher for me as regards rigor in researching these wonderful items, which we'll be showing you in a second. The glasses that you have, everybody usually says, please return the glasses. But you can keep these glasses because we made them for you, special. And I hope you enjoy them. They are special scenes and others. They are mementos of this fabulous occasion. Well, we hope it's fabulous anyway. Okay, here's my little tweaker here. We're here to present to you our new book, A Village Lost and Found. And the subject of the book is the work of master stereoscopic photographer of the 1850s, T.R. Williams, Thomas Richard Williams. And in fact, this book is about one particular part of his work, the particular stereo card series called Scenes in Our Village. And we'll discover more about that as we go along. A few months ago now, we were in a very picturesque English village called Hinton Waldrist in Oxfordshire to launch the book, which was a great full circle because, as you'll see, everything started in this little village about 150 years ago. And it was great for us to complete that circle and take these photographs back to the population, the present population of that village, who had no idea that this had gone on in the 1850s. So it was really a very good feeling, a fulfillment of a dream, really, to bring what we regard as a priceless work of art, which was almost lost to the world, which is why We called the book A Village Lost and Found. It damn nearly was lost, because these cards were scattered all through the all over the planet, and it's taken me, 40 years, I suppose, to collect them all together. I still don't have them all physically. I don't have them all, but I'm lucky enough to know some people who have the missing cards that I don't have, and they've been kindly letting us scan them, and that's why this book represents the first complete collection of these cards ever in the world. Look. Thank you. Okay, today we're going to take you on a journey, a little discussion about T.R. Williams, and then a journey through this particular piece of his work. And to do this, we have a silver screen. This is no ordinary screen. It's a silver screen, and you have to have a silver screen to project in stereo. The particular system we're using is the same as Avatar, really. It's the same kind of thing. It's not quite Avatar, you know, but... But it's the same idea. There's cross-polarized spectacles. These are not sunglasses. They're cross-polarized, and the polaroid spectacles separate out the relevant images for each eye. You have to keep your head straight. I think it's perhaps worth just mentioning this. If you go like this, then things start to go slightly awry, and you get ghostly images, which don't work. So just keep really, really, really still, okay? Okay, what we can do with this silver screen is to give you a kind of parallel experience to the book. The book is actually the best thing of all, we think. You know, if you take the book home and treat it as a kind of intimate experience, that's really what was intended, and that's what T.R. Williams intended in the first place. Okay, this would be a good time to put your fabulous glasses on. And if you have reading spectacles or distance spectacles, I would advise keeping them on and putting the 3D spectacles on over the top. You won't see too much in this. This is flat, but please watch it anyway. there you go. So what is this book all about? It all starts here. This is a stereo card. Forgive me if I speak to many of you who know all this already. You know what a stereo card. But for those of you who don't, stereo cards are quite rare these days. At one time, they were incredibly common. They were like pop records in the 1850s. They became incredibly popular, and millions, literally millions of them were published by the London Stereoscopic Company and others during the 1850s. Now they're quite rare. When I started off this, I could find them in junk shops, antique shops, and auctions and things. Now it's getting... Because I wrote the damn book, it's almost impossible to find them. But we wrote the damn book, I'm sorry. So this is what I held in my hand about 40 years ago and wondered what it was. You'll notice that a stereo card has two images which look the same, but in fact they're not the same, of course. They're two images taken, one for each eye. And you'll notice that we all have two eyes and not one. And this is for a very good reason. We get two images transmitted to our brain from two slightly different viewpoints. And they have slightly different information in them. They have what's called parallax differences. So with your left eye, you'll be able to see around somebody's head this side, and with your right eye, you'll be able to see a piece of the wall behind him on this side. And your brain miraculously combines these images and makes them into a stereo or a solid image inside your head. It's really some kind of miracle, and it gives us incredible depth perception. And you can understand why it gave mammals a distinct advantage in evolution. Am I allowed to say evolution here? Suddenly had a terrible thought. Because it gives you depth perception. If you've got some animal coming at you, you get a great idea of where it is and when it's about to hit you because you have the two eyes, because you have this stereoscopic perception. A man called Charles Wheatstone, in 1840, figured out that if you took photographs corresponding to these two eyes and presented the photographs to your eyes instead of the actual scene, then the whole experience would be reproduced. And this is the beginning of stereoscopic imaging and stereoscopic photography. Almost exactly the same time photography was invented in France and England. And this is a fairly early photograph. They are albumen prints. They're made with egg white and silver salts, and the two images are mounted on a card. If you turn the card over, in this particular case, you get a poem. And that was one of the things which intrigued me, first of all. You always get a poem in this series, and it says at the top, scenes in our village, and then there will be the title of the card, and then a poem, which is sometimes a comment on what the people in the photograph might be doing. Sometimes it's a comment about what they're thinking, or some kind of parable being told, some kind of metaphor. And sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's very touching. You'll see as we go along that these poems allied to the pictures really amplify them. And the sum of the photograph and the verse is something much greater than the two halves. This series is completely unique. There isn't another series like this in the whole world which documents a village in this way. Not only a village, but its inhabitants. Not only the inhabitants, but their whole way of life, their whole photography, their attitude to their neighbours, to their animals, to their God, to nature. You'll see. Due to the miracle of Photoshop, which I love, and I'm sure T.R. Williams would have loved it too, we can see the front and the back at the same time. And I've deliberately chosen a fairly grubby, dog-eared card, because generally that's the way they turn up. If you're lucky enough to find these things, very often they've seen a lot of life, and they might be a bit scuffed, a bit smeared. You know, they fade a little if they've been in the sunlight. If they're damp, they get really sick, and nothing can be done. This one's kind of average condition. Now, it looks fairly flat and ordinary, but of course this card is designed to be put in a viewer. And when you put it in a viewer, which we call a stereoscope, really two things happen. First of all, the image fills our field of view, more or less. And we can't quite do this here, but it's close. You know, in the stereoscope, in the book, it'll work even better. It fills our field of view, so it's something a bit more realistic. But the magic of the stereoscope is that it will feed the left image to your left eye, the right image to your right eye, and you get the sensation of depth. I love doing this. That again, just goes. Now that to me is magic, and always has been since I was about 9 years old. I was absolutely entranced, and I thought, why on earth do people take mono pictures? If they could take stereoscopic pictures, why would anybody bother? Because these are so much more realistic. And you'll notice you feel you can almost walk through that virtual window into the scene. And we are not looking at actors here, like you might be in Avatar or whatever. You're looking at, you know, much though I love Avatar, you know, I think it's a wonderful piece of work. But here you're walking through that window and you're seeing real people doing real things 150 years ago. That's something very unique. If you're lucky enough, instead of getting a dog-eared card, to get a really beautifully preserved card, the illusion is even better. See, that's a ah, isn't it? You know, that's a, oh. And you can see that it gets more realistic as you look at it. You really feel like you could walk in there and you could talk to these people. And this is exactly what T.R. Williams intended. He loved his medium, obviously, and he chose this medium to make his document. This is the kind of stereoscope which you would have had in those days. It's a beautiful piece of joinery, as you can see, and would have been worth a lot of wages in those days, probably about a year's wages for the poor people. We were planning the book and wondering how we could create a stereoscope that would do this. We needed something which was able to be put in the book and used, and also to focus, because it's pretty important. A lot of people will pick up a stereoscope and have a quick look and go, oh, I can't do it. And then forever the magic is lost. They probably don't want to try again. So I had to design a stereoscope which focused and also folded flat. And a lot of people said, no, you can't do that. It's never been done. Well, this is what we came up with. Thank you. With a little help from our friends in Sunbury-upon-Thames in Middlesex in England. And these people are injection moulders. And we, Elena and I, learned the science of injection moulding. It's a very inexact science because as the thing is drying, it warps in various directions. Anyway, you don't need to know that. This is a lot of fun with this. So this thing, the secret is that it folds outwards instead of inwards, which really nobody had done before. This is what it does. And you'll notice it's only got two pieces. The hinges are integral because of the particular kind of material which we chose. You just have to make it thin enough, and it will bend. And these things will flex. These hinges will flex 100,000 times without breaking. So it'll serve you well. So here we have a 21st century viewer, which we call the owl, partly because it looks like an owl, partly because it has outstandingly wide lens separation, which is important, actually, because you get a kind of prismatic effect with the lenses, which helps you in your viewing. 21st century viewer with an 1850s card. That's an original there, and it works just fine. But, of course, the viewer was designed... Oh, here we have Elena who's showing you how to use it. Yeah, you hold the back and focus with your thumbs. So we hope you'll have fun with that. It definitely works for about 99.9% of the people we've tried it on. I have to tell you right now, maybe I should dive it. The thing to do is not imagine that you're looking at some little insect through a microscope. You have to relax with a stereoscope and imagine you're looking through binoculars to infinity, and then it'll all happen. The magic will happen. It was designed for the book. This is the crucial thing. So in the book, you will find a number of pairs, reproductions of the original cards, and the book is the viewer is designed to be located on these stereo pairs. Bring your head to it, and then focus, and there's your stereoscopy, your stereoscopic image. Okay, now down to business. This is T.R. Williams himself, the great man. He's not really a great feature in most of the conventional histories of photography, but nevertheless, he was a very important figure, quite a pivotal figure in stereoscopic photography, and a hugely successful portrait artist in his own right. This is a self-portrait, and it is a stereo daguerreotype. Now, daguerreotype cameras, you don't have a shutter and the usual apparatus of normal, you know, of modern cameras. You just basically take your lens cap off and expose and put the lens cap back on again. So he would have had an assistant do this for him, and this is the man himself. The quality is so beautiful on these stereo daguerreotypes. You can zoom in and really get to grips with the man, and I often look into his eyes and wonder what he was thinking at this moment. He died very young, at 47, and we think it was connected with the lethal chemicals which he used for the daguerreotype process, and also for the other process which was used for Scenes in Our Village, which is the wet plate collodion process. Just want to briefly tell you the other things that he did. This is 1851 Crystal Palace, the dream of Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's beloved husband. It was only up for 1 year in Kensington Gardens, in Hyde Park, in London. And T.R. Williams seems to have done this when he was an apprentice to Monsieur Claudet, who was already a very successful daguerreotype artist, photographer. These are very rare. He seems to have just done them for himself, so he didn't make these for sale. This kind of material, T.R. Williams seems to have started to make his name with. They're called still lives, and they follow a pattern, a style of a lot of European painters, the still life compositions. They all have a meaning. They all have a subtext. This one is called Mortality. Perhaps. Actually, strangely enough, there's no title ever been written on it. Or some people say this is called Vanitas, which is the old meaning of Vanitas, meaning not really vanity, but emptiness. So this is meant to represent the fundamental emptiness of life. And you see this means of measuring time, the skull, etc. But they are such beautifully perfect compositions. And they're essentially compositions in three dimensions and not two. If you close one eye, it's still quite a nice picture. With the two eyes, you can see how he's positioned everything to fill the space and balance in the stereoscopic space. Here's another one. This is called Cock and Fox. And sadly, they're not alive because... well, actually, they weren't. Because if they were alive, they would have moved around. The exposures were quite long for these. They'd be a few seconds. And there's actually three animals in this picture, as you can see. Yeah, this little guy is down the bottom. Here he is. There are very often little secrets in T.R. Williams' work. He likes to put little clues in there, and very often the clues are about himself. And in a day when there was a lot of bootlegging going on, it was perhaps quite important to sign your images inside the image. And this image is signed in there. It's quite hard to see, but if you look at that little piece of sacking, which is hanging down at the very left, if we zoom in on that instead now, you can see TRW. He manages to get his signature in very often. So it's nice little treasures to find in his pictures. This is another one. This is a particular favourite of mine because there's some of my favourite things in there, as you can see. has some interesting clues too, because the daguerreotype process is a one-off thing. So you're looking here at the plate which was actually in the camera. And of course the camera reverses everything. And you can see that this guitar is reversed. Otherwise it's a left-handed guitar, you know, but we're pretty sure that it is a right-handed guitar and it's been reversed by the process. But this is called articles of vertu, so precious objects. And this is T.R. Williams' work as a portraitist, a little boy, and we don't know his name, but people would flock to his studio. It's been said that T.R. Williams was very modest, and he didn't even have his name above the door in the Oxford Street premises where he worked, but people flocked of all classes to have their portraits taken. And here's one of them. Here's another. This one is a picture of one of T.R. Williams' relatives. This is his auntie. She's called Elizabeth Taylor, strangely enough. and we will hear from her later. We will hear from Aunt Taylor, as she's called. This speaks for itself, really. It's really... He's so far ahead of his time, really, in his compositions. This kind of thing was done a lot in the 1950s, in the boom of 3D in the 1950s. But really, T.R. Williams and some of his friends did just about everything that could be done with stereo in those few short years. We know who this is. This is Lily Williams. This is his daughter, his eldest daughter, Lily. And we are lucky enough to have met some of her descendants, and that's another story. But that we were very fortunate to find people who actually could trace them, their lineage back to this little girl and back to T.R. Williams himself. This lady is Princess Vicky. She's the daughter of Queen Victoria, and T.R. Williams was commissioned to take portraits of her on her 16th birthday. She married a Prussian prince, and as some of you may know, it's a bit of a sad story because she went off to live in Germany and was deeply unhappy, and then gave birth to a little boy called Bill, who later declared war on England. It's put her in a pretty difficult position. But there's a beautiful portrait, I think. This actual portrait was passed down in her family, and I was lucky enough to be able to purchase it at a certain point. This is, again, Crystal Palace, but not in 1851. This is the rebuilt Crystal Palace in 1854. Which was a huge deal by that time. They'd been forced to tear down the 1851 exhibition because it was, people objected to it taking up room in the park. So they reassembled it much bigger down in Sydenham. And there it stood for many, many years until it burned down in about 1930. This is the opening ceremony, and Queen Victoria and Prince Albert are in the front. By this time, T.R. Williams is a very popular photographer, and he's been commissioned to take a whole series of pictures of the 1854 Crystal Palace. But we think that the strongest thing in Thomas Richard Williams' mind was memories of his childhood. We know that he spent some of his childhood in a little village in Berkshire, as it was then. It's in Oxfordshire now because they moved the boundary, strangely enough. Which is why I couldn't find it for 40 years. Nice little trick there. But this is the church which allowed us to find it. I won't go into the details. We could talk about it in questions and answers if you like. But this is the church where it all starts. It's the church of St. Margaret of Antioch in Hinton Wardrist. And at this point, I'd like to hand you over to my esteemed colleague, Elena Vidal, who will take you for a tour of our village in the 1850s. Thanks very much.
Let's now join Tia Williams for a few moments in his stroll through the village, our village. Because of time limitations, we will only see a few of the images out of the 59. We shall see a few disappearing people, curious girls, romance, and chatting neighbors, and much beauty and much to ponder. So here we start our journey at the church. This is St. Margaret of Antioch. And this is, of course, the center of the village where the community meets. This image shows you is a winter image, but there's also a summer one. Of course, this is telling us that Tia Williams produced this series over a period of time. And here we meet the first neighbors. Tia Williams says in the verse for this card,
"The church. Long be our Father's temple ours. Woe to the hand by which it falls. A thousand spirits watch its towers. A host of angels guard its walls."
This is the manor. It's a beautiful house then and now. This is the manor now. As you can see, it is pretty much unchanged, save for the addition of a second floor and a few minor alterations. And here we go back to the original image. The women in the foreground are Elizabeth Taylor, who you met before, and Mary Simmons. Elizabeth, on the right, is Tia Williams' aunt and is commemorated in a stained glass window in Hinton Church. She also was the companion or carer of Mary Simmons, sitting next to her on the left. Now, the lord of the manor was John Lowther Simmons. That's the gentleman on the left holding a gun. He was a very keen hunter. And he was a squire. He was practically the owner of the entire village. The land belonged to him, and everyone that lived in his land, everyone worked for him. Now, who can this gentleman be? With his top hat and his city attire, isn't that Mr. Williams of Regent Street? In truly Hitchcockian fashion, he likes to appear in his own work. And you might see him later again.
"Lo, to thy peaceful scenes do I return, my home, and hail thee with a joy sincere. Each well-known object meets my earnest gaze and whispers to my heart the bliss of home."
So now that we have met the squire and part of his family, let's make our way down the road through our village.
The road through our village. Unmodernized, unfashioned by the great, our ancient hamlet keeps its quiet state. Seldom you'll visit a more peaceful scene, for visitors are few and far between.
This is a view of the high street, looking eastwards. The building on the left is the old shop, and it's still standing there today, although changed almost beyond recognition. Now, if you look at the man in the top hat and the child, and we zoom into the image, well, we are pretty certain that this also is Tia Williams himself, perhaps reliving a moment from his childhood when he was a small boy being led by the hand down this familiar street. Now, in case you are wondering what this is a wet collodion negative. We were very lucky to find it in the Getty Halton Archive in London. All the images in this series originally came from negatives like this one. Now, to produce it, you have to use gun cotton, ether, and a few more not so nice chemicals. It is, in fact, a highly complex process. And we tried it ourselves. We can tell you that it is a very messy and a very difficult procedure. Having said that, we successfully took a few wet collodion images of Hinton walrus a few weeks ago, and you will see them at the end of the talk. Now, time seems to have stood still when we see the dame and spinning wheel. Indeed, at the time, spinning wheels were no longer much in use, as Thea Williams tells us.
The dame and her spinning wheel, the last in the village. A generation long hath passed away, and yet another passes day by day, and still the ancient dame her labor plies, as when she saw that generation rise, and in despite of age cannot forget the dress she sported when a young coquette.
The age of mechanization was knocking at the doors of Hinton Walrus. Change was very much in the air. And this disappearing way of life is precisely what Thea Williams is showing us throughout the series. Let us now meet two hard-working villagers.
Maria Carson's washing day. Poor Mary, from field labor once a week must stay, and this to keep home clean she makes her washing day. Born to hard work, her clothing coarse and mean, yet see her kin and cot how exquisitely clean. John Sims at his pigsty. John with content now views his fattening hog, dreams of plump bacon and the Christmas log. For this, with him, in truth, is dainty fare, but to complete the feast, we add the pomme de terre.
And here is Mrs. Sims, come to lend a hand. Now, we still remember when we first arrived to Hinton Walrus and discovered John's gravestone in the churchyard. It was a very exciting moment for us. It might seem a bit strange, because it was the confirmation that the characters in the series were all real people.
The cottage. They call it a cottage. 'Tis more like a mansion. It only requires a little expansion. A pediment, two or three pillars and turret, at a decent expense, if they choose to incur it.
Now, this beautiful house is special to us. Thea Williams's aunt lived here, and this is also where his future wife lived for a few years. The house no longer exists. It is now the site of a swimming pool in Glebe Farm. Now look who is standing at the door. Now the series not only depicts the village and its people, but also some of the occupations which are mainly to do with farming. So we have arrived at harvest time. This is turning barley, not a fun job, as it transpires from the verse.
The children of labor, how hardly they toil, turning the barley and trenching the soil. Little they think, who are lounging at ease, how wearing and tedious are labors like these.
If you look at the farm laborers, they are all carefully positioned to optimize composition and the stereoscopic effect. But see, there is one lady that perhaps was too curious, and she had to have a look. Now, you might be able to see her if you're looking out of the second cottage from the left. But we will show you a detail. Now, try shutting one eye and then the other. And you will see something very strange happening. Well, maybe this lady couldn't contain her curiosity. She peeped out between the left and right exposures. She really had to have a look. Now, this is telling us that Tia Williams took all these stereo images sequentially. That means he did not use a stereo camera as such, but took one photograph, moved the camera 7 or 8 inches to the side, and took another picture, of course, hoping that people wouldn't move between and during exposures. And we think this is the kind of camera he used. It is a very unusual piece of apparatus. To explain why it has two lenses, one above the other, would take some time, but you can find out in the book. This is loading the wheat cart. The elegant man in top hat and waistcoat seems a bit out of place, but certainly adds interest to the composition, with the long pitchfork and formal appearance. It is quite a curious combination. Who is he? Well, perhaps Tia Hitchcock again.
Oh, weather-wise, how little can the husbandman rely on the harvest sun that blazes from the firmament on high. For ere the evening closes, may the whelming flood descend, and the hopes that he had nourished may prematurely end. So, while it shines so brilliantly and all above is fair, pile the last load of corn, and thus for every change prepare.
This is rick making. We are now in Lovell's Court Farm, a couple of miles to the south of the village center. And just round the back of that hedge is a barn.
Bread and cheese in the barn. What condiment like appetite to make the hungry diner eat for hunger's sake? Content and happy with their bread and cheese, the sensualist might envy such as these.
Our friend Ken Holden sadly misses. He scouted the surrounding areas of Hinton for this particular barn and finally found it. And so we meet the Cox family, the present owners, standing here at the very same spot 150 years later.
Complete with their doggy.
The dog moved.
Bad doggy.
So now let's meet some of the children in Hinton. Our favorite must be our dear Thomas, posing for us at the pigsty. This is quite an unusual portrait for the time and an even more unusual verse.
Thomas, standing for his picture, half pleased, half frightened, that strange tube he eyes, in sheer astonishment and mute surprise, yet fears it almost with instinctive dread, some deadly weapon levelled at his head.
Thomas appears in other views as well. So this is taking corn into the granary. This particular card shows very, very fine hand coloring, as you can see. And this is Thomas again, loading the dung cart.
loading the dung cart. Scorn it not, it is a needful task. Nor would the husbandman of nature ask for aught more rare, more treasured, or more prized than this rich load by others so despised.
Thomas was definitely a very hard worker. Just as the other children in the village, he was part of the workforce. Very little time for video games then. Another little star in the series is little Polly.
Little Polly, gone fast asleep. Sleep, while yet no sin nor sorrow in thy bosom makes a throe, or fierce passions cause a smart in thy yet pure infant heart. Sleep, and may thy conscience be ever as 'tis now free, nor one crime hold there a place to cloud thy happy, joyous face.
This image is also a huge technical achievement. It is the only view taken indoors. And of course, the little cottages were very dark inside, having very small windows. So Polly probably was fast asleep and motionless, allowing the necessary long exposure. Now, let's meet Martha and Daniel at the churn. This was taken at the Grange. Yes, romance is also part of life in Hinton Walgrist. It seems that finding time for courtship amongst the numerous tasks and hard labor is quite difficult. So here we find a young couple in the midst of the daily routine popping the question.
How eloquent a simple, truthful word. It wakes the inward heart as soon as heard, its power acknowledged, and no high-bred miss is made more happy when she simpers yes. The doctor's one-cow dairy.
Yep. This is still at the Grange. At the time, it was the home of David Lloyd. He was a doctor and a farmer, and he was also the brother-in-law of the Lord of the Manor. And there's a modern photograph of the very same site. It's a beautiful house. You only see part of it. This is the rectory. It's a lovely study showing the church in the background. Luckily, the rectory still stands as magnificent as ever today. And this is the rectory today with the present owner. Here, as is often the case, it is hard to reproduce exactly the angle of view which Thea Williams adopted, since there is nearly always a hedge in the way, or a tree, or a telegraph pole. But in this modern view, we can still see the church close by. So now, since we are nearly out of time, and we cannot show you the whole series, let us enjoy just half a dozen more images, simply accompanied by the verses, and some quiet time for contemplation. The first is a direct and very unusual poetic reference to the medium of stereoscopy.
Lane leading to the farm. Seen with the artist's eye, how many a spot on nature's face that seems a simple blot teems with rich images and beauties rare. Taught to appreciate, the traveller there, marvels that he so often hath before, unknowing, unadmiring, passed it o'er. Thus, what is cultivation to the eye of the taught artist, stereoscopes supply. The blacksmith's shop. Fair without and foul within betokens many a gaudy sin, but, like this smithy, oftentimes 'tis found an outside dark and foul contains within a soul bright as the sunshine that is gleaming round. The remains of the old hall. What scenes of bygone days these roofs recall, their crumbling buttresses and ruined wall. And yet, how little shall we ever know of all their pageantry and all their pride. What broken hearts were there, what joy or woe, who lived in splendor or in sorrow died. The ferry. Men wait the ferry, so in endless strife, to ferry over evils pass their life. The ferry crossed, fresh evils bar their way, each in its turn, or mastered day by day. The church, seen through the trees, twilight. There is a silence in the hour. The bee's sweet hum is scarcely heard. No zephyr fans the fragrant flower, and not a timid warbling bird is there to break the sacred charm that binds my heart to thoughts of thee. A view of our street. How calmly and how peacefully it lies, and half deserted seems to manhood's eyes. The spot where once a boy I gambolled free, and all was life and happiness to me. And yet 'tis all unchanged, each well-known cot, each garden tree or wall, and every spot that once was as a world to me, is there. Alas, the change is mine, not what I then thought fair. And that brings us full circle. Thank you very much. Thanks very much. Thank you. We'd be delighted. Thank you for being such a great audience. You're full of passion and life. We love you. We'd be delighted to take questions. If you have a question, please put up a hand and we'll get a microphone to you so everybody can hear the question, okay? Shall we start with you, madam, seeing as you're close? But wait for the microphone to get to you, if you would, please.
How did they color the black and whites? Is that all hand-colored?
It's all hand-colored, yes. Each individual card would be hand-colored, which is quite a difficult task because you have to color both sides, obviously, the same. I've been trying it myself. There's a little secret. I actually colored this one. This is from a negative, which we were lucky enough to find, and I applied the colors to this sampling T.R. Williams' card. So the miracle of Photoshop can get you a long way. But love Photoshop. I'm secretly advertising them. But in those days, it would be watercolors. And very often they put a glaze on top. Elena will tell you more.
Yeah, well, basically that's it. Really, you know, they were varnished so that because they were, you know, being watercolor, they were very sensitive. But of course, there's a huge range of the quality of coloring. You have seen here some very fine coloring, and you know, it could vary a little bit. in terms of quality.
Sir?
Do you have any idea how many sets they made, or were they sold individually or sold as a set for a family to look through when they were originally manufactured?
We've never found a set of any description, and there's only one list of apparently all the views. We think they were sold separately, and possibly as more views were taken, more were put in the marketplace. It's very difficult to say how many were actually published. Probably of each view, the maximum you would ever find. John Sims at his pigsty is a very popular view, obviously, at the time, because there's quite a few surviving. I would say in the world there might be, we've probably seen about 50, possibly, 40 or 50. But, for instance, Young Thomas, as he's called, there is only one existing card of him we've ever seen. So they are very, very rare. Also, you know, there was a huge boom in stereo photography, but this is very early on in the boom. These really were the trailblazing pictures from T.R. Williams, and after T.R. Williams came a lot of other photographers who took up this kind of style or else went into what they call sentimentals or comics, where every picture is telling a story, but there's a deal of acting involved. This is a much more sort of naturalistic approach. Elena?
Yeah. Well, I was going to add one thing. The London Stereoscopic Company produced the images, and they had huge premises. They could really produce very, very large numbers of cards. I mean, not only these ones, but I think the 1856 catalog already is listing around 100,000 images. So this was a bit more upmarket, this series, but still it was a huge boom in the 1850s. All the stereoscopic images were produced in very, very large numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Their motto was a stereoscope in every home. And they pretty nearly pulled it off, I think. This is our motto too now. Madam, in the pink, could I?
I'm wondering about the physical cards themselves. I'm assuming it's like a card stock, but is the image integral to it, like printed on it, or is it like the later Keystones where it's a separate photographic image, or is it a thin paper?
It's stuck on. There are two albumen images on quite thin paper stuck on. The Keystone people and Underwood followed the same method about 50 years later, around the 1900s. But these would all be hand done. Every stage would be hand done. And an immense amount of work, actually. The pictures, first of all, but then the developing, then the printing, which was done by sunlight, and it's all contact printing. There's no enlarging here. And then, of course, the assembly and the colouring. They're very labour-intensive. You couldn't really do that these days. We're trying, but it's quite hard to do. Thanks. Okay. You're right.
Yes?
Sir?
No, sorry.
Señorita Veda, bienvenido a Filadelfia.
Muchas gracias.
Dr. May, welcome home.
Thank you, sir.
One of the things that sort of makes me wonder, now, this is 1850. 10 years from now in the United States, Gilbert Stuart and Matthew Brady are going to be doing a lot of, you know, two-dimensional shots of the Civil War, getting really famous. And a little bit later, Muybridge is going to settle the bet for the governor of California about whether the horse's legs all left the ground at the same time or not. Wondering, was anyone around that time, of course you've got, you know, Lumiere is about to come up, but was anyone even considering trying to make these move?
Trying to make the move?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Strangely enough, yes. There's a chap called Tim Freeze Green. Oh no, what was his first name? Freeze Green? Edward Freeze Green, I think. Mm-hmm. In England, who constructed a marvelous camera with a winder, and it took sequentially stereo pictures. And that stuff is still in the British in the Science Museum. At least I think it's still in the Science Museum. So, yes, strangely enough, these sequentials give you an impression of movement, and we think it was perhaps deliberate on T.R. Williams' part, because always something moves. You know, you tell people to stay still, but they don't. Something happens. You notice very often in these pictures they're propping themselves up against a wall or a wheelbarrow or something. And the trees will move very gently. You see branches move. You see a lady's skirt just blowing in the wind. All kinds of things happen. In this, actually, in the distance, you can see... a horse and cart is just disappearing right down the end of the road. And on the right, there are some ghostly images of people who were walking in one of the images and not the other. So you do get a kind of sense from these sequentially produced stereos of motion, which we love, I have to say. And I think T.R. Williams loved it as well. They're sort of imperfections, but they give away so much of what was going on at the time.
And if I can add something also, Antoine Claudet, he was T.R. Williams's teacher. He already recognized the fact that movement could be studied in taking sequential photographs. And I think he mentions it in one of his papers as well. So I think he probably is the pioneer of certainly the visionary, the one that saw the potential of photography in terms of movement. And this is already, you know, early 1850s.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here as well. I mean, Langenheim, a celebrated resident of Philadelphia, produced some absolutely exquisite glass stereos around this time, also wonderfully hand-colored. We were looking today to try and find some here, but unfortunately they don't seem to have any. As is very often the case, you look for a local photographer in the local library and it's not there. Possibly because this kind of art wasn't really appreciated at the time, you know. And yeah, so very often these images land up in the hands of collectors. And it might be nice in the future if people like us could donate some of this material to the library of the place where it originated. Sir, with a beard.
Brian, there's a photograph of you in the front of the book and with a big smile on your face, and you're wearing surgical gloves. Is that, obviously you're not doing surgery, but is that a precaution to protect the images?
Yes, that's standard.
I took that photograph when we went to see. That was taken at the Getty Halton collection. That's where we found the negatives. And he's handling one of the negatives, and you know, you should be wearing cotton gloves because otherwise you leave your fingerprints in the ground.
It's a lucky shot, actually. I don't usually do it. I have to say, I tend to be naughty. But the funny thing is...
Wow, sorry. There's another one with...
But the funny thing is, when you're wearing these gloves, it's quite hard to hold these things securely. So I always slightly worry holding these beautiful gloves, because things can slip out of your hands. So I tend very often not to wear them. It was lucky that I was photographed doing the proper thing. Thank you, Elena. Yeah. Okay. Sir? Also with a beard. It's a magnificent beard here today.
Thank you. I'm interested in the fact that stereo photography blossomed at the start of photography, then sort of died off, I guess, a little bit after World War I. I'm interested in what you think might be the reasons for that. My wife and I have been collectors for some time, and I take stereo photographs myself. And my theory is, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, is that after a while, people were looking at things differently. They wanted more realism, and these are not, in fact, realistic. They're what you see is not a stereo image as we see it in reality, but a series of discrete planes, of discrete images in receding into the distance, which is not how we actually perceive the world. And at some point, people became disappointed with that and wanted a return to greater realism. Interested in your thoughts on that.
Okay. Can I take this first? Yeah. In some ways, I would disagree with you. But a lot of people say they see discrete planes in these photographs, but that's actually not the case. Because if you look at some of these images of people, actually, I can start spinning through some of the ones we haven't seen. A lot of the objects you see in the image will not only be located in planes, but they will have solidity. You will see the contours of the object, and that's always the case in stereo. I think that the illusion of these planes comes about because sometimes the stereoscope, the depth is exaggerated. Now, T.R. Williams is an expert at this. T.R. Williams loves to exaggerate the stereo, and I think that's part of the charm of what he does. The Village always has a little bit of a heightened depth effect, and I think maybe that gives the impression that they're discrete planes, but they really shouldn't be. Now, on the other hand, I agree with you, because I think it's about disappointment, you know. And I think there's a grave danger it could happen now. We have a fantastic explosion once again of 3D, the same as what happened in the 1950s with things like the House of Blood. It was a big thing in the 1950s. And, you know, you have someone like James Cameron who spends 10 years of his life devoted to making a wonderful work of art and getting the stereo exactly right so that you come out of the cinema feeling that you were actually there. But then you have a lot of people who jump on the bandwagon, shoot stuff not in stereo, and then process it to make it in stereo. And the result is people come out with headaches and never want to go back and see another stereo movie. I think there's a great danger of that. I also think the TV thing is risky. You know, people are plowing ahead with stereo TV now, but you have a choice between having to sit in one spot in your living room and not move with your lenticular screen, or else being able to move but having to wear spectacles which are quite heavy and have to have batteries and somebody will sit on them and they'll break. You know, I think choosing to go and see a movie and enjoy that experience, and what we're doing now is one thing, but I think having in your home and being sort of tied to these devices is still risky. I think people might get really fed up with it, and then the whole thing will disappear and plunge into obscurity again. Elena, would
you? I agree. What can I say? Also, you know, one has to say not everyone can. Well, coming back to your question about photography, not everyone can see these views in 3D. I mean, here it works because, you know, we have set up everything like this, but in the viewer, some people do have difficulty, and that might contribute also to kind of a slow, you know, growth in, you know, kind of letting down a little bit. And of course, you know, there were always new fashions that came in, you know, new forms of producing photographs and new ways of presenting them that became, you know, a big hit. And so, you know, people moved on from stereoscopic images to another type of photographs.
Yeah, I would add that we've, in our book, gone to great lengths. We've been working on this for years, and we were very anxious that people would have a good experience with the book. And that's why we spent so much time developing the viewer, which was easy and can be used by almost everyone to get this magic effect. We also spent a lot of time and trouble getting the printing right, because even good quality art printing in books is not good enough to be viewed through a stereoscope. All you see is dots. So the printing in our book is stochastic, which is a special process which randomizes the dots. It's not quite as good as a photographic print, but it's very close. So you can use our book, hopefully, and get the proper experience. And I hope people will be brought in by this experience and want to experience more. I'm just spinning through a little bit. This is also in the Manor grounds here. Interesting thing is here, the man is standing in the boat and trying to stay still. He's got his punt stuck in the water, but he has moved a bit, and the result is that he doesn't quite stand out in front of the reeds as he should do. He seems to sort of sink back into the reeds. I don't know if you can see that. And there's a close-up there. Again, this is from the negative. We can get such fine quality. We were so lucky to find a few of those negatives. Like you mentioned, my eureka moment. We found them in a commercial archive filed under somebody else's name, so we were really... It takes... You know, a lot of work, but a lot of luck as well to find these things. But having got the negative, with a lot of cleaning up in Photoshop, for hours and days and sometimes weeks, then you come up with something like this. And again, I've colored this, but in the colors that were used originally. And quality is amazing, amazing. Here's another close-up from these are the guys. You see the guys leaning against the wall, trying to keep still. Notice also they look like they have very dark skins, but this is probably an artifact of the process. The wet plate collodion process is completely insensitive to anything except blue, pretty much. So the pinks of the skin come out as very dark. And when we were doing our wet plate collodion experiment, we noticed that as soon as the sunlight started to fade and the ultraviolet and blue came out of it, we were using incredibly long exposures. Mm-hmm. And it does give this effect to the face, right?
Yeah, and at the time also photographers used to hand out instructions to sitters, you know, to people that wanted a portrait taken. They would give some advice as to how to dress because of this problem, because of the sensitivity to certain colors and insensitivity to other ones. So they were quite discouraging of, you know, like red dresses because they would come out quite black and so on and so forth.
Yeah, he would be developing on site. He would have a mobile darkroom with him. And it's a difficult process. The plate has to be wet in the camera. It has to stay wet, a little tacky. And you have to make your exposure, get it out, put it in the developing bath. And at that point, you can use a red light to look at it because of the fact that it isn't sensitive to red light. So you can see the development process. And then you've got to put the other plate in and move the camera and take the other picture. All this time, the people have got to stay still. So it's not as easy as it looks, this business. Oh, this is interesting. This illustrates another thing. I don't know if you'll notice the difference between these two pictures, apart from the colouring.
Look at the background.
So if you look at the tree, somebody decided this tree wasn't a very acceptable part of the composition. So long before Photoshop, they simply painted it out on the negative.
How much free Photoshop stuff do you get?
I wish.
No, this is original. This is the original retouching of the negative.
Yeah. T.R. Williams liked retouching. We think he would have liked Photoshop. I was saying two more questions. I'll keep spinning through, though, if I may. This is Little Thatch, and you may see that in a little while. Can we have 5 minutes more? Are you okay for that? Okay. Oh, good. Okay. Remember, this is Little Thatch, because we'll see it in a minute again. This place we don't know. We never found this, because we were lucky with the village. It really could have been something like... Well, I always say Reading, but you guys don't know what Reading is like, probably, but it's concrete. You know, basically, you know, we were really lucky that the village does still exist, and it was very hard for us to find it, but there it was. Not all of it remains, though. This is old Giles, it is grindstone. This is a chat, by the way. And these cottages still exist as well, in pretty good state of preservation, and the thatches are still there. In some cases, people replaced the thatches with other kinds of roofing, but these thatches are still there. These are gleaners waiting at the gate. The gleaners are allowed to go around after the harvest and pick up what's left, and they can use it for their own home devices. You know, these are very poor people, so they just scrabble around on the grass to find what's been dropped.
Yeah, and it was usually the women and children that were the gleaners. That's what you see here as well.
We put this in because this is an interesting example of what happens if people don't do as they're told. See, this woman's moved her head, and the head completely disappears because...
Yeah.
In fact... This is going to school. And this is the village schoolmistress, also a very touching picture. She's the retiring schoolmistress. And there's also a river trip, which I have to spin through very quickly. They go for a trip down the river and do some fishing. This is the upper reaches of the Thames. It's called the Isis up there. And they obviously had a great time, and I think this is something close to T.R. Williams' soul. The weir is now gone. There's another view of the weir. We were able to find these trees. These trees are coppiced. They're cut down so they'll make spindly shoots, which can be used for thatching. But when we arrived there in 2003, they'd grown huge. And unfortunately, one of them was washed away by the floods last year. This is a whole hamlet right next to the Hinton Ward, just down by the river. It was the river port, and it's all gone now. Every single stone and brick is gone. It's just gone back to nature, which I find quite comforting, really. It's not a car park.
Or a shopping mall.
This is old Dancy with his pipe. And again, this cottage survives. We visited these people. We had a great time getting to know the villagers and taking part in their favorite activity, which is gossip. Just very quickly then, these are the pictures we took when we were down there just a few weeks ago with the original camera, or the type of camera that T.R. Williams used, and the original process, the original wet plate whole scenario, which is really difficult. We had some expert help with this. Two Americans called Scully and Osterman, and they're the world experts in wet plate collodion photography. And they came down with us, and this is our results. You notice this one doesn't have any people in, and you suddenly realize how important the people are in T.R. Williams' views. They really bring it to life. The scenes would be nothing without the inhabitants. So we put our own inhabitants in. There they are, trying to keep still. Not doing a very good job of keeping still, I'm afraid. I mean, in fact, really bad job of keeping still. I don't know who these people are. This is the manor from a different view with a beautiful overhanging tree. This is a classic stereo composition, which I think T.R. Williams would have used if the tree had been there when he was there. Quality is so good of collodion that you can really zoom in, and the definition is still there. So if I zoom into this same negative, it's still pretty sharp and clear. And in fact, at the end of this, it's got a bit out of sequence. I'll show you the end of that in a minute. You can zoom in even further, and there's a gardener there who was really trying to keep still and doing an even worse job. Here's the man here. This is Elena and our present manager of the London Stereoscopic Company, Sarah Brickus, who's in London holding the fort. So we're recreating the composition of the T.R. Williams original. This is Little Thatch. You saw Little Thatch just a minute ago, and this is beautifully preserved now. They're all restored. They have built onto the side of it, though, so we can't quite get the angle, but the well is still there. And this is the family who lives there now. A delightful family.
The boy moved.
Yeah. Yeah, I rather like the fact that the car's there, because it's sort of incongruity there. And these are our hosts when we go down there. They're a fantastic family. I did a portrait of them. We did this, and adding a little color makes a big difference. Here's the rectory again. This is Sue, the fox hunter. Doing a very good job of pretending that she's just clipped the head. She did a very good job, because you bear in mind she had to stand there for about 4.5 minutes.
Yeah, it was a long one. Yeah.
And these people, the Cox family, they're the same ones that you saw with the little dog. in bread and cheese in the barn. We went back, and they'd bought this wonderful cart from one of their relations, and it's almost exactly the same cart that we saw earlier in T.R. Williams's view. And there they are, they're a wonderful family, farming family. Again, color makes a difference, but it takes a lot of time. But in Photoshop, you can't do anything. And this is a motley crew. This is our team. I think that's slash in the middle. This is a scene which we perched ourselves on the bridge and took a scene just as the sun was setting. And because of the long exposures, you can see the streams moving. It produces a lovely effect. I'm quite proud of that one. And here's the little boy who belongs to the caretaker of the manor, and he sat in what he called his oracle, which I think is a coracle. But he was able to sit very still. He had to sit really a long time because the light was fading, and these exposures were how long? Probably a minute each,
yes,
and then a long time period between. So he did a really good job of staying still.
That was really hard.
You can see a little bit of difference between the two images as the light's fading. And this is the last one in the sequence of the manor, and we've zoomed in even further. And there's still a bit of definition there. You can see the poor old gardener who's getting a bit weary towards the end of that. And I think that's the end of our little trip. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As Freddie used to say, thank you for your time and thank you for your money. We'd be delighted to sign stuff if you want. Thanks so much. You've been a great audience and we really appreciate it. Thank you.
You head right back. I'll meet you back there. We'll let everything sit.
Great.
Exit, even though it says exit, you've all
got
to... Thank you.
We should keep going.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.